outcome of this judgment. Danjuma Abdullahi, Kaduna.
Thousands of Ethiopian refugees crossed the Sudanese borders on Monday, arriving at Taya village at Basunda locality in Gadarif state. Reports say the refugees is considered the biggest number of refugees to cross into the country in only one day since the outbreak of war last November in Tigray region. Many believe that the wave may worsen security and humanitarian situation in the region due to armed conflicts erupting at western area of Ethiopia.
Sudan has adopted an open-door policy in receiving Ethiopian refugees since the beginning of the conflict. So far, Sudan has welcomed about 75 to 80,000 refugees. We call on the international community to help us meet the needs of the increasing refugees fleeing from the fight in the Tigray region.
Since the beginning of fighting, tens of thousands of Ethiopians have sought safety in Sudan. But conditions in Sudan refugee camps are presenting a new challenges, as Sudanese NGOs early responded to humanitarian situation in states affected of refugees influx.
Actually, since the crisis of the refugees started, the Tigray crisis started, Sudanese Red Crescent has been present from day one. And that is basically because we do have our ongoing activities in the region through our branches in Kassala and Gadarif. So we do have ongoing programs for the already existed old refugees in the area. So with the beginning of the crisis, we were already on the ground.
In the light of the latest development in the Tigray region, UN agencies strive to maintain a strong staff presence, provided there is access in Hamadayet in case there is an increased influx. Several partners continue to remain on the ground in anticipation of this possibility.
Security and health challenges face Sudanese and Ethiopian governments to cope with increasing number of refugees. Khartoum says it is still waiting for international support to tackle the crisis. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
An Algerian judoka athlete who made headlines last week for shunning an Israeli opponent at the Tokyo Olympics has now been temporarily suspended along with his coach from the International Judo Federation, meaning that Fethi Nurin will not be able to compete after making his bold statement in support of Palestine. After returning to Algeria, V secured an exclusive interview with Nurin to ask why he felt he had to walk.
I was pitted to play against an athlete from the usurper entity occupying Palestinian land, a regime which kills innocent people and drives them out of their homes, day and night. Because of this, I don't accept that my hand is smeared with someone who represents an entity like this, and for his flag to be associated with the Algerian flag, which is in support of the Palestinians' cause.
His actions meant he would miss out on a chance to win a medal, but Nurin admitted he had no regrets.
If the same situation arises, I would not hesitate to take the same decision. The world needs to know that Israel is an occupier and they practice all kinds of laws that deviate from the international laws and human rights. We need to send a message to the world that we deal with all religions with dignity, just as the Islamic religion recommended us to do. Except for the ones who fight against the religion and the Muslims. We are against them and it's our rights to respond to them. We have the right to defend our religion and all oppressed Muslims.
The Olympic Charter takes a strong stance against any political acts, stating that no kind of demonstration or political, religious or racial propaganda is permitted.
However, this isn't the first time that a Muslim athlete has protested against this controversial lineup. Many are now starting to ask questions about the Olympics and their lack of sensitivity on the subject. Also, are the games being used to whitewash Israel at a time when Palestinians remain deeply oppressed? Robert Carter, London.
More and more people in the EU are congregating indoors. The highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 is spreading like wildfire in countries like France and Spain. More people are also travelling within the EU. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts on the Delta variant.
I don't know where the cases come from, if it's a coffee restaurant or just meeting in our house.
When I see how people are behaving sometimes, yeah, I'm not surprised.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, says economic confidence is being undermined.
The pandemic continues to cast a shadow, especially as the Delta variant constitutes a growing source of uncertainty.
On Monday, EU finance ministers rubber-stamped COVID-19 recovery funding for four additional nations in the 27-country bloc.
Croatia, Cyprus, Lithuania and Slovenia. Now more than half of national plans is adopted.
However, critics say the billions of euro being administered to national governments will result in citizens being saddled with decades more austerity because there is too much emphasis on loans rather than grants. According to analysts, EU leaders are harming the bloc's economy through their foreign policy. Sanctions are inhibiting trade. Economists say the Iranian market represents a big opportunity. It can be availed of if current efforts to save the JCPOA-Iran nuclear deal succeed. We have been speaking to the head of the European Parliament's Iran delegation about the subject via Skype. She believes the agreement will be reinstated soon.
Many people in Iran say, oh, again and again and again. We have not a good partner on this side. This is one of the impacts of this horrible, stupid policy of Trump.
The International Labour Organization, ILO, warns an additional 25 million jobs could be lost globally before the end of this year due to the coronavirus. However, the ILO says if we see an internationally coordinated policy response, the number of people losing their jobs could be much lower. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanese Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati said he hoped he can regain the trust of the people in the role of the state. He also vowed to meet with President Michel Aoun regularly in order to speed up the formation of the new government.
There was full unanimity on demanding swiftness in the formation of the new government. And after today's session, I briefed President Aoun on the outcome, and I always visit the presidential palace in order to achieve the government's formation as soon as possible.
Mikati spoke after a day of non-binding meetings with Lebanese lawmakers who stated their views after separate consultations. Free Patriotic Movement declared it will not be taking part in the next government, but will offer all the necessary facilitations and support for a quick formation.
We're starting from scratch. We're starting something new, no baggage. No one is carrying any historical disagreements between the parties. That's what we heard from the designated prime minister, and we hope that that will be reflected in the coming future, within hours or days at least, that this will make a difference.
Prime Minister Designate stressed that he has the foreign support necessary to begin economic reforms. One member of parliament told Press TV that when they asked about this support, Mikati stressed that France has given him assurances that after the formation of the cabinet, they will give all assistance to resolve the financial and economic crisis. However, this assistance will not be without interest.
No foreign country would give assistance for free. It has its own interest in mind as well. It's only natural when France gives aid to Lebanon, it has ambitions. If France assists in rebuilding the port, it could be the main future authority in the port of Beirut and could be managing the trade and commerce from Europe to the entire Arab world. If it rebuilds the electricity sector, it will also be a good investment for French companies. And at the same time, Lebanon is in drastic need of that assistance.
The main concern for all sides is salvaging the country's economy, which has been described by the World Bank as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. After initial meetings with lawmakers, the real political bargaining begins for the formation of the government. This in itself could prove to be controversial, with Mikati stressing the need for keeping to the French initiative, opponents stressing the need for adhering to the National Charter of Confessional Representation. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government has decided to expand blanket stop-and-search powers under a new plan to beat crime. Measures unveiled on Tuesday include changes to police powers to allow searching people without suspicion in areas where they believe violence could break out under the Section 60 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act.
Across all stop and searches powers, black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped than white people. But under the Section 60 Act, that rate is even higher at a whopping 18 times. Moreover, the research data shows that in 99% of Section 60 searches, no weapon is found.
Press TV got a reaction to this story from Charles Critchlow, former president of the National Black Police Association. He said,
"This government has abandoned any pretense of a desire for a fair and just society, particularly insofar as black people are concerned. First of all, the efficacy of such an approach is not proven. Moreover, it's counterproductive in that it alienates the community when the support of the community is critical."
His thoughts were echoed by Solomon Lee, a community activist from Black Child Promotions, who himself has been harassed by the police.
There's always going to be conflict at street level. There's disorganised crime, then there's organised crime. And as I said before, black youth cannot facilitate any criminal underworld. They can only participate. A lot of black youth, they're serving time, even though we're 3% of the population, according to the 2011 census, we're disproportionately represented in the prisons at Her Majesty's pleasure.
The government announcement came 2 months after the Criminal Justice Alliance, a network of 160 organisations, called for the power to be repealed, arguing that Section 60 had led to thousands of innocent people being unnecessarily stopped and searched every year, with the number of searches rising from 622 in 2016 to 2017 to more than 18,000 in 2019 to 2020. It seems unlikely that Priti Patel will bow to pressure from campaigners after already dismissing the criticisms levied against the plans, much like she dismissed the sentiments behind the Black Lives Matter protests that swept throughout the UK. Ahmed Cabello, London.
On the occasion of the Eid al-Ghadir, Iran has officially begun vaccinating prisoners across the nation against the COVID-19 virus. Speaking at the vaccination ceremony, Iran's deputy health minister said that in view of the existing capacity and availability of vaccines, all prisoners will receive the first dose of vaccines in the next 10 days.
In view of the existing capacity and availability of vaccines, all prisoners will receive the first dose of vaccines in the next 10 days. Thanks to the proper observation of health protocols by prisoners, the average number of people infected with the virus in prisons has been less than ordinary people.
In the past couple of days, with the imports of foreign-made vaccines and the entry of domestically produced vaccines into the vaccination basket of the country, the pace of vaccination process has increased to the extent that, according to the Iranian health minister, the country has set a record of vaccinating over 430,000 people on a single day.
In the occasion of the auspicious Eid al-Ghadir, we have begun vaccinating all prisoners across the country. To vaccinate all prisoners and those working at prisons, we need over 200,000 doses of vaccines. This amount has already been supplied, and the vaccination process for prisoners will continue as planned. At today's ceremony at Evin Prison, in Tehran, 250 prisoners were among the first to receive the jabs.
Moreover, centers for drive-in vaccination across the country have been established, and they have played a major role in the increase in the daily vaccination rate. Iran is using a combination of locally produced vaccines and imported foreign-made vaccines in its national vaccination program. According to Iranian health officials, the country's homemade coronavirus vaccines develop immunity against the new mutations of the virus.
According to Iran's health ministry, almost 60 million Iranians will be vaccinated against the virus by the end of the current Iranian year in March 2022, using domestically produced and foreign-made vaccines. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate. Thank you.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, says what's happened since the 2015 nuclear deal was signed vindicates the fact that the West is not a trustworthy interlocutor. Not much has changed for a complying Iran. The Trump-era maximum pressure policies is still there under the Biden administration that's not even willing to guarantee it won't violate the deal like its predecessor. Washington says the ball is Iran's court. Tehran blames the U.S. and its excessive demands. Both sides say the negotiations cannot go on forever. In the spotlight tonight will be the fate of the Iran nuclear deal. Stay with us. Let's watch a report first.
The arduous road of reviving the Iran nuclear agreement seems to have come to an impasse. So far, the U.S. has claimed on multiple occasions that it is willing and ready to return to the nuclear accord, but its actions show otherwise. On Thursday, Iran's ambassador to the Vienna-based international organizations outlined some of the U.S. and its allies' as demands. Kazem Gharibabadi said the U.S. has demanded talks on Iran's regional influence and its missile programs in return for removing sanctions and fully implementing the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. He also noted that the U.S. refuses to comply with Security Council Resolution 2231 that removed the ban on the transfer of arms to or from Iran on October 18, 2020. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump sought to extend the ban, but the U.N. Security Council rejected Washington's push. Gharibabadi said the United States has also failed, among other things, to give assurances that it will not repeat its previous behaviors regarding the deal. A day earlier, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, slammed Washington for its stubborn demands in talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal, and said the United States had failed to guarantee that it would never abandon the pact again. He said the U.S. once violated the nuclear deal at no cost by exiting it. Now they explicitly say they cannot give guarantees that it would not happen again. Tehran says its mistrust in Washington was vindicated in May 2018, when former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled his country out of the deal and reimposed sanctions as part of his administration's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Now, 3 years after Washington's unilateral withdrawal, U.S. officials claim they're willing to remove sanctions on Iran. But in practice, they're refusing to do so, fueling Iran's mistrust of the U.S.
The ball remains in Iran's court, and we will see if they are prepared to make the decisions necessary to come back into compliance. We are committed to diplomacy, but this process cannot go on indefinitely.
This as Blinken has in the past described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy. Given Washington's refusal to rejoin the JCPOA, Iran started to gradually reduce its commitments under the deal, citing the remaining signatories' failure to uphold their obligations and neutralize the impact of the U.S.'s unilateral measures. Now, while the resumption of talks in Vienna has been postponed until the new administration in Iran takes charge next month, the fate of the JCPOA still seems to be hanging on American politicians, who have so far shown no sign of readiness in altering their anti-Iran policies.
Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Behruz Najaf, and I'm going to discuss the Iran nuclear deal tonight with these gentlemen. Journalist and political commentator Mostafa Khoshesh in Tehran. And West Coast coordinator of the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker in San Francisco. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's start with Tehran. Mostafa, the U.S. quit the 2015 nuclear deal under Donald Trump, and that was despite the fact that both Washington and the IAEA confirmed Tehran's compliance. Now, how can Iran trust the Biden administration and go on with negotiations for which Washington is not even offering any sort of guarantee?
Hello, Beresin. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Well, actually, there is no way to trust the United States. The JCPOA itself displayed to the Iranians that they could never, ever trust the United States. It was not the first time, actually. In the past two decades, Iran and the U.S., or its European allies, they have had six agreements, with the JCPOA being the last one. And all these agreements, according to American officials and European officials, as well as and some of them, according to IAEA reports, Iran has been in compliance with its undertakings. And because it has always thought that the U.S. and its European allies are looking for a conflict resolution, while the U.S. and its allies have never complied with the terms of the agreements, because they've just been looking for containing Iran's power, and they have not looking for they have not been looking for conflict resolving the conflict. Well, as a matter of fact, Tehran has only one option. You know, in international relations, when there are treaties, especially if one of the parties is a member of the UNSC, the UN Security Council, then you have to be very watchful, you have to be on guard, and you have to keep the pressure, and I mean, of the, your power in your hands, because there is no other way to guarantee yourself. Even the congressional approval doesn't work in here. The United States withdrew from over a dozen agreements under Donald Trump. Some of them had congressional approvals, from Iran nuclear agreement to INF treaty to Paris Climate Accord, NAFTA, Transatlantic. It withdrew its membership from UNESCO, and it threatened to discard the, its membership in WHO. So some of them had the UN backing, the UN Security Council backing, and congressional approval and endorsement, but still the U.S. didn't care, because the United States feels that it's exceptional in the terms of President Obama, or America first, as Donald Trump said. So they feel might is right. So in that aspect, Tehran has no other way but to make sure that the opposite side is complying with its agreement. That's why Iran has stated and insisted that the U.S. should first remove all the sanctions in compliance with JCPOA, and Tehran should verify it and see if it it's happening in action. Then Tehran would comply with its undertakings, because these undertakings are Tehran's leverages on the United States.
Okay, now to San Francisco. Richard, one of the sticking points is the U.S. refusal to provide guarantee. It won't leave the pact again. Washington violated the nuclear deal, and at no cost, of course, and exited it. So why do you think Washington is not committing itself to a deal by actually offering some tangible sort of assurance or guarantee?
Well, I agree with the other guests that even if there are the congressional guarantees, they are not really guarantees. They are seen in Washington as temporary in character, as are all the treaties and agreements that the United States government has entered into with either countries or peoples or agencies that it views as being in opposition to U.S. policies in any ways. I mean, if we can go back through the history of treaties in the United States, the hundreds and hundreds of treaties with Native peoples on in the continent, which were all regarded as temporary treaties. The withdrawal from international organizations that your other guest mentioned, which are also viewed as being in opposition to U.S. interests or the interests of that particular administration. The real objective of the Biden administration and its foreign policy team, which is really a neocon formation, is to weaken Iran. That's their view, their objective, their goal is to weaken Iran's presence in the region. And to find ways in which to do that. So now you have the Blinken-led effort trying to impose new conditions or get Iran to accept new conditions in order to have the JCPOA revived, perhaps only on a temporary basis. And one of the problems here, of course, one of the big problems, and this was a problem with the JCPOA when it was signed, was the uncertainty of what is called the international community over whether or not the agreement was going to hold. Mm-hmm. And the consequences of that were to prevent many companies and financial institutions and countries, governments, from doing much in the way of relaxing the sanctions. There was some relaxation, for sure, but many of them held back from engaging in what is considered, if you can consider it that way, normal trade and normal commercial and trade relations with Iran because of an anticipation, or at least the possibility that the agreements could be canceled by the U.S. government on a unilateral basis at any time.
Now, Mustafa, Blinken is saying that his country is waiting to see what Iran is ready to do or not to do and make a decision. Iran has done what it's supposed to do, hasn't it? So it's the U.S. that abandoned the deal. So how can Blinken say that the court remains in the ball remains in Iran's court?
Well, you're right. Iran has done its part. there's no doubt about that. Iran stayed under the nuclear deal for 14 months after Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear accord in May 2018, in the hope that the Europeans would at least comply with their undertakings and would make up for the loss. But they never took any action, and then Iran started modifying its undertakings. And it took a year for Iran to go after these modifications, but still it stayed under the nuclear deal. Iran is still under the nuclear deal. It's a party to the deal, but the U.S. has exited the deal, and therefore it's the U.S. that should make up for the wrong actions that it's done. And this has been acknowledged even by other parties to the deal, not just the Russians or the Chinese, the Europeans. Until a few months ago, they acknowledged that the U.S. should take the first action because they left the deal and they are still outside and they've caused much damage to Iranian economy. But let me tell you, Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, is completely wrong and right. He's wrong for the fact that I just said, but he's right because it seems that the U.S. is very much adamant to do the right thing. So they need a new impetus, a motivation. This could be done by Iran in a couple of ways. It could reduce pressures on the U.S. and give in to the U.S. demands and say, okay, let's go ahead with whatever you give us and you said in the last round of talks in Vienna. Well, Iran has already done this option when it started the JCPOA talks and it signed the deal. It agreed to give some concessions in return for the U.S. concessions, and we know what happened, that the U.S. defied the deal altogether and it never complied with it. The same is true about the Europeans. And it could also go the other way. It could motivate the U.S. through increasing pressures. And it's already done that once, and it has received a very positive response. Let's remember that when Biden took office, he said Iran's nuclear deal is not a priority. If Iran wants us to prioritize revival of the nuclear deal, they need to reverse their actions in the modifications that they've done and go for a full resumption of their undertakings under the nuclear deal. So Iran never did that. They motivated Biden, but not the way that he desired. They increased the pressure through a parliamentary approval that laid more pressure on the White House through four leverages. And then Biden changed the approach. And in a matter of 3 weeks, he sent a delegation to the Vienna talks. So Iran increased the pressure, and it worked. The same is true this time, I believe, especially with a Raisi administration in office, and especially after all these experiences that Iran has had through, under the nuclear deal with the United States. I believe Iran is preparing to increase pressures on the United States in order to motivate Mr. Blinken and his boss.
Okay. Now, Richard, Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, had warned already on several occasions that the West wouldn't commit itself to implementing its undertakings under deal. It even would ask for more. He had warned it. You just give him an inch, I'll take a mile. And that's exactly what happened. Instead of trying to return to the deal it left, is asking for discussing some other stories not related to the nuclear issue, like Iran's missile program and regional activity. Let's have your take on that.
Well, the Trump administration was much grosser. Its foreign policy was self-evidently imperialistic and degrading to other countries. The Biden administration's foreign policy team isn't that way. They're more diplomatic, but it reminds us that of an old saying that diplomacy is perjury. And I think in this case, you know, we can see that it is. What the U.S. officials, the top officials in the foreign policy establishment in the United States, are pursuing what is essentially the same objective as the Trump administration and many before it, since the time of the Iranian Revolution, that is to bring about regime change, and if they can't achieve regime change, to weaken Iran's influence in a key strategic area of the world. That's what the objective mm-hmm. really is. So they're going forward in this way because that objective has not changed. And it will be interesting to see, as Mustafa mentioned, whether or not the increased pressure from Iran will push the Biden administration into an agreement. I should also mention that the Biden administration has continued its extremely hostile, position toward Venezuela and toward Cuba. And despite having said in the run-up to the election that it would go back to the Obama administration's position on Cuba, that has not happened. And in fact, the sanctions against Cuba have been increased by the Biden administration. And that should be a sign of how they stand in regard to other countries they regard as adversaries, meaning Venezuela, Iran, North Korea, et cetera, China.
And Mustafa, the United States insists to kind of tie and link Iran's missile program and regional policies to the nuclear deal. Now, and Iran says that these issues are not on the table, they are not negotiable. Why should anyone, I mean, nobody would negotiate their deterrence power, would they?
No, of course not. But let's remember that up until 2005, the United States tried every option, and it considered many scenarios and possibilities to do a regime change in Iran. But after a series of developments in 2006 and the rise of Iran's power in the region, they started developing schemes in order to contain Iran. They realized that they may not do a regime change, and they need to go for introductory steps before they could do that. They needed to contain Iran's power. And when Obama was elected to office, and even a couple of months before that, they had a manual, they had a strategy that was called containment strategy, working through a carrot and stick policy. On one side, they tried to, you know, build Iran's confidence that they are willing for a conflict resolution this time. On the stick side, they used military threats, credible military threats, but of course not action. If action was possible, they would have already done that. But they posed military threats alongside sanctions, a new regime of sanctions that was completely different to the sanctions before or imposed on any other nation, including Iran. And then they hoped that they increased the cost so that they could push Iran to talks. Then, in the first step, they hoped that they could slow down Iran's progress in each of these three areas of Iran's nuclear industries, Iran's missile power, Iran's regional clout, though it would not stop there. Once they embraced success as a result of this formula, they would go on and on and on, and they would ask for Iran's drone industries, they would ask for Iran's laser industry, and right. So on and so forth. When we said that, they were just looking for Iran's ballistic missile containment, but now they are also asking for containing Iran's cruise missile industries in their recent remarks. Both Ned Price and
Mustafa, we're running out of time.
Let me wrap it up. Yeah, okay. Let me wrap it up just one sentence. So what they intend to do is good if they go all this way along through multiple agreements, slowing down Iran's progress, stopping it, and then rolling back Iran's power components in all these areas. So one agreement is not good, but they need to have to revive this nuclear deal and continue it in other areas in order to contain Iran's overall power. Okay. That's the ultimate purpose.
Okay,
and Iran has realized that they would never allow them to
do that. Richard, we only have 30 seconds. Iran seriously doubts and mistrusts the U.S. intentions. Does it have good reasons for that?
Well, it does. And I would just point out that containment in the verbiage of U.S. foreign policy has always actually been a polite term for overthrow.
Okay. All right. With that, we come to the end of this Spotlight show. Let me thank our guests. We had journalist and political commentator Mustafa Khushchesh in Tehran and West Coast coordinator of the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, who joined us in San Francisco. And that's it for this edition of The Spotlight. I've been your host, Behruz Najif.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Globally, there's been an encouraging downturn in new coronavirus cases in May of 2021, but cases are still at a very high level overall, with worldwide statistics masking huge differences across countries and areas. Stay with us for an article concerning this issue written by Michael Head, Senior Research Fellow in Global Health at University of Southampton in England. The piece is titled, The Nations Most Likely to See Next Big COVID Spikes. The piece has been taken from The Conversation website. Beneath COVID-19 complexities, there is a simple hypothesis. If the coronavirus is introduced into a susceptible population and those people are able to mix, there will be significant community transmission. We have seen this happen around the world, including in India recently. Could we see similar situations with cases rapidly spiking and health systems being overwhelmed? Well, the short answer is yes. Globally, there's been an encouraging downturn in new cases in May of 2021, but cases are still at a very high level overall, with worldwide statistics masking huge differences across countries and areas. The global vaccine rollout is also progressing slowly, with most of the world still susceptible to COVID-19. These factors mean there's potential for further spikes like those seen in India. We only need look to Nepal to see a similar situation unfolding there. Other countries have rising caseloads too, with many eyes looking nervously at Latin America, Southeast Asia, and some of the smaller island nations. Our World in Data website highlights Laos, Timor, Thailand, Cambodia, Fiji, and Mongolia as countries where numbers have recently doubled in the shortest period, from 16 to 23 days for these countries. For comparison, the doubling rate for India ahead of its second wave was 43 days. When looking at countries where reported deaths are doubling most quickly, it's Timor, Thailand, Mongolia, Cambodia, and Uruguay. They range from 4 days to 31 days. For countries such as Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam, highly praised so far, the problem is their high susceptibility. They've had few cases in the past, so there is little natural immunity in those countries, and they're now experiencing outbreaks amid an inability to procure a large vaccine supply. Vaccine coverage, therefore, is low. Thailand and Vietnam have given a first vaccine dose to only 2% and 1% of their populations, respectively. Elsewhere, it's the mixing part of the equation that's more of a concern. For example, Japan is soon to host the Olympics, attracting athletes, dignitaries, coaches, and media from every corner of the globe. Despite a ramping up of vaccine distribution over the past month, the program has been sluggish, with less than 4% of the population having received a first dose of the vaccine. In this author's view, the Olympics should not go ahead this year in Japan. Latin America continues to experience a huge burden of COVID-19 and so is also at risk. Argentina, Uruguay, Costa Rica, and Colombia are all still in the top 10 countries in terms of daily new confirmed cases per million people. On the other hand, sub-Saharan Africa has, on the face of it, with some exceptions, handled the pandemic relatively well, with countries praised for an early and decisive response, having learned lessons from the West Africa Ebola outbreak of 2013 and 2016. Of course, our conclusions must be cautious. Creating high-quality real-time data during a public health emergency is complicated, and data is patchy and slow in most parts of the world. For instance, the extent of transmission in refugee camps and in conflict settings is very much unknown. Some vulnerable areas may slip under the radar. The reporting of data may also be influenced by local politics. Some countries, such as Tanzania, have chosen to downplay the severity of the COVID-19 pandemic. The former Tanzanian president, John Magufuli, died in March of 2021, and news coverage suggested he may have died of COVID-19 amid reports of uncontrolled outbreaks around the country and sharp increases in deaths. However, officially, the impact of COVID-19 in Tanzania has been low. Similarly, Belarus is reporting low death rates, 27.8 per 100,000 population, having refused to consider COVID-19 as a serious threat. But the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation has modeled the country's actual death rate to be one of the highest in the world, at 472.2 per 100,000 people. The timing of elections and volatility of political governance may be interesting factors to observe when trying to predict future spikes. Political mass gatherings in India are likely to have contributed to the extensive recent transmission of the coronavirus. The Prime Minister and Health Minister of India encouraged people to attend these political rallies, wrongly believing earlier in the spring that India had reached the end stages of the pandemic. Elsewhere, former US President Donald Trump's campaigning events caused numerous super-spreading events in the United States. While in Myanmar, there were reported breaches of COVID-19 protocols due to electioneering and mass gatherings. Myanmar's elections in October of 2020 were preceded by the highest spike in cases the country had experienced. Soon after the election, stricter policies were put in place and case rates lowered. Countries that engage in similar behavior, or like India, declare success too early, could well be the next hotspots. Of course, the next outbreak may prove difficult to spot. Few of us could easily point to Timor on a map. This lack of knowledge influences our perception over local situations and also the news coverage that countries get. Compare Nepal and Timor to Brazil and India, on which public reporting has been extensive. Plus, some countries might not be reporting good quality data, may have much bigger burdens of COVID-19 than appears to be the case. The next big outbreak will be reliant on a perfect storm of a few variables coming together. At the core of this storm will be a slow vaccine rollout and susceptible populations mixing freely. Political rallies, large-scale festivals and protests are examples of mass gatherings that can seed new outbreaks of the coronavirus and facilitate sufficient spread to rapidly overwhelm a healthcare system. But depending on where this happens, we may not even notice.
Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Millions of Americans face the risk of becoming homeless as a nationwide ban on evictions expires. Fighting rages on between government forces and Taliban militants on the outskirts of three major cities in Afghanistan. And rebels kill six civilians and wound several others in an attack on a village in the northeast of the Central African Republic. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Now, millions of Americans are facing eviction from their homes as of Sunday when a ban on booting out